11. Up and out. The trip from the Hilton out to the end of the tether was more subdued than the first leg. Only 27 of us, and all headed for Mars, except Dr. Porter. We did the gravity thing in reverse, slowly weighing more until we would, temporarily, have full Earth weight at the end of the tether. We couldn't go back to using the gravity-operated toilet. Didn't want us to get used to it again, I suppose. When they fling us off to Mars, it will be zero-G again. We spent a lot of time sitting around in small groups talking. Some about Mars, but mostly about who we were and where we came from. Most of us were from the States, Canada, and Great Britain, because the lottery demographic was based on the amount of funding each country had put into the Mars project. There were families from Russia and France. The flight following ours would have German, Australian, and Japanese families, a regular United Nations, except that everybody spoke English. My mother talked to the French family in French, to stay in practice. I think some disapproved, as if it was a conspiracy. But they were fast friends by the time we got to the ship. The mother, Jacques, was backup pilot as well as a chemical engineer. I didn't have much to do with their boy, August, a little younger than Card. His dad, Greg, was amusing, though. He'd brought a small guitar along, which he played softly, expertly. The Russians kept to themselves, but were easy enough to get along with. The boy, Yuri, was also a musician. He had a folding keyboard, but evidently was shy about playing for others. He would put on earplugs and play for hours, from memory or improvising, or reading off the screen. Only a little younger than me, but not too social. He did let me listen in on a bit of Rachmaninoff he was practicing. Rock 3, Piano Concerto No. 3, and he was incredibly nimble. I studied piano for 5 years and quit as soon as Mother would let me. I'm an avid consumer of music, but will never be a producer of it. Our doctor on the way to Mars would be Alfonso Jefferson, who was also a scientist specializing in the immune system. His wife Mary was also a life scientist. Their daughter Belle was about 10. Son Oscar maybe 2 years older. The Manchester family were from Toronto, the parents both aerologists. The kids, Michael and Susan, were 10-year-old twins I hadn't gotten to know. I didn't know Murray and Roberta Parienza well either, Californians about our age. Murray, the younger, whose parents came from Mexico, an astronomer and a chemist. So our little UN among the younger generation was 2 Latins, a Russian, 2 African-Americans, 2 Israelis, and a Chinese-American, slightly outnumbering us plain white-bred North Americans. We'd all be going to school via VR and email during the 6-month flight, though we started going on different days, and of course would have class at different times, spread out over 11 time zones. If Yuri had a class at 9 in the morning, that would be 10 for Davina and Elspeth, 11 for August, 5 in the afternoon for us Floridians, and 8 at night for the Californians. It was going to make the social calendar a little complicated, as if there was anything to do. Meanwhile, we could enjoy the extra elbow room we got from dumping off the 9 tourists. I moved upstairs to sit next to Elspeth, which put Roberta on my right. Dr. Porter rolled her eyes at 3 young females in a row and told us to keep the noise down or she'd split us up. That wasn't exactly fair, since the little kids were the real noisemakers, and besides, most of our parents were on the second level, too. But you had to have some sympathy for her. The littlest ones were always testing her to see how far they could go before she applied the ultimate punishment, locked in the seat next to your parents with the VR turned off for X hours. She couldn't hit them. Some parents wouldn't mind, but others would have a fit. And she couldn't exactly make them go outside to play. though if she did that once, the others might calm down. It was no small trick to get a recalcitrant child back to its place while we were still in zero-G. They'd push off and fly away giggling while she stalked after them with her gecko slippers. Hard to corner somebody in a round room. The parents or other adults usually had to help. What finally worked was escalating punishment. Each time she had to strap a kid in, she added 15 minutes VR deprivation to everyone's next punishment. No exceptions. At 10, they were old enough to do the math, and started policing themselves and behaving themselves. A small miracle. We went a little faster on the second half, and it would have taken only 4.5 days, except we had to stop again while the robot repaired a tear in the tape ahead. I had a vague memory of watching the news when they started building the 2 Mars ships 11 years ago. They'd taken the fuel tanks from the old pre-space elevator cargo shuttles, cut them up, and rearranged the parts. The first one, the Carl Sagan, was assembled in low Earth orbit. The second, up at GEO, where the Hilton is now. I guess the elevator wasn't available for the first. Anyhow, they both took a long crawl up here, spiraling slowly up with some sort of solar power engine. The first one took off while they were still working on ours. The Sagan had made 2 round trips and was on its third, in orbit around Mars now. Ours had only been once, but at least we knew that it worked. Of course, a spaceship doesn't have to be streamlined to work in outer space. With no air to resist, but the fuel tanks these were built from had gone through the atmosphere, and so they looked kind of like a hokey rocket ship from an old 20th century movie, though with funny-looking arms sticking out on the left and right, with the knobs we'd be living in. We could see the John Carter a couple of hours before we got there, at least as a highly magnified blob. Slowly it took shape, the stubby rocket ship with those 2 pods. Once we were on the way, it would start rotating, once each 10 seconds. The carrier slowed down for the last couple of minutes. Strapped in, we watched the spaceship draw closer and closer. It wasn't too impressive, only 90 feet long, unpainted except for the white front quarter, the streamlined lander. We were going in through the side of that, a crawl tunnel like we'd used for the Hilton, but with gravity. The carrier came to a stop, and Dr. Porter and Paul put on spacesuits to go check things out. They came back in a few minutes and said things were fine, but a little cold. The air that came through the open airlock door was wintry, colder than it ever gets at home. Paul said not to worry. We'd warm it up. They opened the storage area under the exercise machines, and we all pitched in, carrying things over. There were some pretty heavy boxes, a lot of it food and water for the trip. Starter water that would be recycled. I'd almost gotten resigned to the fact that a little bit of every drink I took had gone through my brother at least once. You could see your breath. I had goosebumps and my teeth started chattering. Barry and his parents were the same way. Fellow Floridians. My parents and Card seemed to have some Eskimo blood. A lot of the stuff we stored in the Mars lander, under Paul's supervision. Some of it went into A or B, the pods where we'd be living. That was sort of like the Hilton in miniature. There was a relatively large zero-G room, a cylinder 22 feet long by 27 feet wide. On opposite sides, there were 2 4-foot holes, A and B, with ladders going down. No elevators. It was all kind of topsy-turvy, with the temporary gravity we got from the elevator cable's spin. Up and down were normal in the little spaceship, the lander. Pretty much like an airplane, with seats and an aisle. But carrying stuff back into the zero-G room, we walked along the wall. We carried stuff down a ladder into B, and strapped it into place. Then we waited back in the elevator while they turned the thing around 180 degrees. Then we could go down A's ladder. I couldn't get warm. Fortunately, one of the things I delivered was a bundle of blankets for sleeping A. I was A8. So after we finished, I liberated one of the blankets and wrapped it around myself. Saying goodbye to Dr. Porter was more emotional than I would have thought. Tears that acted reasonably rolling down your cheeks. She hugged me and whispered, "Take care of Card. You'll love him soon enough." She went back to the carrier, and the airlock closed. Paul warned us we all had 30 minutes to use the toilet. Then we'd be strapped in for almost 2 hours. I didn't really need to go, but might as well be prudent. And I was mildly curious about what I'd be putting up with for the next 6 months. I got at the end of the line and asked my reader for a random story. It was an amusing thing from France, a million years ago, about a necklace. The zero-G toilet was the same as the carrier's, but without the little camera. I didn't miss it, nor did I miss the target. We strapped into our seats in the lander and waited for 20 minutes or so. Then there was a little clank sound, the cable letting go of us, and we were in zero-G, flung away. Most of the speed we needed for getting to Mars was free. When we left the high orbit at the end of the space elevator, we were like a stone thrown from an old-fashioned sling, or a bit of mud flung from a bicycle tire. 2 weeks of relatively slow crawling up to the top built up into one big boost, from the orbit of Earth to the orbit of Mars. We had to stay strapped in because there would be course corrections, all automatic. The ship studied our progress, then pointed in different directions and made small bursts of thrust. It was only a little more than an hour when Paul gave us the all clear to go explore the ship and get a bite to eat. Compared to the space elevator carrier, it was huge. From the lander, you go into the zero-G room, which was about 3 times the size of our living room at home. The circular wall was all storage lockers that opened with the touch of a recessed button, no handles sticking out to snag you. You climb backwards down the ladder, in a 4-foot-wide tunnel, to get to the living areas, A or B. Both pods were laid out the same. The first level, for sleeping, had the least gravity, close to what we'd have on Mars. Then there was the work-study area. Basically one continuous desk around the wall, with movable partitions and maybe 20 view screens. They were set up as fake windows, like the carrier's default mode, thankfully not spinning around 6 times a minute. The bottom level was the galley and recreation area. I felt heavy there, after all the zero-G, but it was only about half Earth's gravity, or 1.7 times what we'd have on Mars, the next 5 years. It had a stationary bicycle and a rowing machine with sign-up rosters. You were supposed to do an hour a day on them. I took 7 a.m., since 8 and 9 were already spoken for. Elspeth and Davina found me down there, and we had the first of a couple of 100 lunches aboard the good ship John Carter. A tolerable chicken salad sandwich with hot peas and carrots. Card showed up and had the same. He made a face at the vegetables, but ate them. We'd been warned to eat everything in front of us. The ship wasn't carrying snacks. If you got hungry between meals, you'd just have to be hungry. I suspected we'd find ways around that. It was a lot more roomy than you'd expect a spaceship to be, which was a provision for disaster. If something went wrong and one of the pods became uninhabitable, all 26 of us could move into the other pod. Then, if something happened to it, I guess we could all move into the zero-G room in the lander. I don't know what we'd eat, though. Each other. "It's your turn now, Card. Be a good boy and take your pill." I sat down at one of the study stations and typed in my name and gave it a thumbprint. I had a few letters from friends and a big one from the University of Maryland. That was my orientation package, though actual classes wouldn't start for another week. It was very handy. Advice about where to get a parking sticker, dormitory hours, location of emergency phones, and all. More useful was a list of my class hours and their virtual reality program numbers, so I could be in class after a fashion. It was a little more complicated for me than for the kids actually on campus. Up in the right-hand corner of the screen were UT, Universal Time, and TL, Time Lag. The time lag now, the time it took for a signal to get from me to the classroom, was only 27/100ths of a second. By the time we got to Mars, it could be as much as 25 minutes, or as little as 7, depending on the distance between the planets. So if I asked the professor a question at what was, to me, the beginning of the 50-minute class, he'd already be halfway through Earth time. He'd get my question while everybody else was packing up their books, and his answer would get to me 25 minutes after class was over. Actually, it would be even more complicated once we were on Mars time, since the day is 40 minutes longer. But I didn't have to worry about that until we got halfway there and switched. Ship time was universal time, until we hit the halfway point, which put us on the same schedule as people living just upriver from London, which I guess had made sense when they were planning things on Earth. Why not go straight to Mars time? Whatever. I got a few pages into the college catalog and my body said sleep. Even if it was only 2. 1400 to the folks in merry old England. I dragged my blanket up to the light G sleeping floor and wrapped myself up in it, and slept till the dinner bell.